I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Obama is in Columbus, Ohio today. He's already held a kitchen table conference with Joe and Rhonda Whiteman, a family he says benefited from the stimulus, and then a sleeves-rolled-up backyard town hall meeting with their neighbors. Here's Michael Riley, a contractor, grateful for the stimulus money.
It's keeping me and my crews afloat for a while, but what we really need is a stronger housing market here in Columbus. We need to be building new roads and making houses affordable for people. They need to get out there buying. They need to be able to get the loans, and what's up with that?
What's up with that? A sentiment perhaps reflected in the polls. The new AP poll gives the president the lowest marks ever on handling the economy. Let's touch in with Michael Shear, White House correspondent for The Washington Post. And Michael, the president had a long and probably to him important response. He said, you know, the reason we built so many homes over the last 10 years, and that's why we have this inventory of unsold homes, it's going to take a while to absorb it. But is that kind of message getting out?
Well, it's getting out. It's just not resonating with people very much, right? You know, you've had a presidency that came in promising or predicting that, you know, if the policies that his administration put in place were done, then, you know, unemployment would probably peak at 8%. Of course, it went much higher than that. It went to 10% and then is now down to 9.5%. And so you've got a lot of folks like this fella who, may be pleased with some of the things that the president has done, but overall looks forward and says, you know, things aren't great, and you know, we don't have a good housing market, the jobs are not coming back as quickly as we want them to, and as you say, the polls are reflecting that frustration.
Well, and as he was saying, you know, people are not getting loans. Average people aren't getting loans from banks. Again, what's up with that? Others like Matt Bye in the Times today writing that, you know, perhaps there's nothing this president could possibly do about this economy but wait for it to come back. But what are Democrats thinking about the president's role going into the midterms? Will it be more of these backyards and also fundraising trips?
Well, you know, it was interesting watching today. You sort of made me nostalgic for Iowa and the Iowa caucuses, when we'd go around and the candidates would talk with eight and 10 people in a backyard somewhere. I think actually you're unlikely to see a lot of that in the next couple of months. You know, the president's poll numbers have dropped to the point in many places where it's not clear that that simply going into a place is going to do a lot to turn around the numbers for these candidates. I think what you'll see more of is what he has done the first few days of this week, which is fly from one big city to another to raise millions, literally, of dollars that at least can be the one silver lining for the Democrats, which is they seem to be going into this election season with more money than the Republicans will have.
Well, Michael, one last quick question. As we reported yesterday, Republicans are hoping to make that Islamic Community Center two blocks from Ground Zero a campaign issue. Today we hear Governor Patterson in New York planning to meet with developers to talk about a land swap. But people also seem to be waking up to some Republican hypocrisy on this issue. A conservative, Laura Ingraham, for instance, who was very much for the center just a year ago. And there's also a split in the party. You've got Grover Norquist, Republican National Committee Chair Ed Gillespie, furious about this tack. They say it's going to hurt Republicans. Do you see, and briefly, do you see this topic turning at all?
Yeah, I do. In fact, I talked to a Republican consultant yesterday, a friend of mine who advises these candidates, and said, look, if we're talking about this on October 15th in the last couple of weeks before the election, we're going to be in trouble. Not that they still won't win a lot of seats. There seems to be a tide for Republicans. But, you know, they need to be talking about the economy. That's what has the Democrats back on their heels. You know, this is an issue that they'll already have most of the people who feel the way that the Republican candidates do, but they need to talk about the economy, not about the mosque.
Michael Shear, White House correspondent for The Washington Post, thanks as always.
Sure.
The most controversial parts of the new Arizona illegal immigrant law are now on hold. But in pushing for that law, did officials inadvertently paint their state as so crime-ridden that they scared away tourists? And did those pushing for the law include the state private prison industry, which would stand to benefit if thousands of illegal immigrants were rounded up and new prisons were needed to hold them? These are provocative questions raised in a report by the local CBS affiliate in Phoenix. A third of Arizona's prisons are now privately run, and there's a push to privatize the rest. And two top aides to Governor Jan Brewer have ties to the companies that would run those prisoners. CBS 5 investigative reporter Morgan Lowe has hopped over to KJZZ Radio in Phoenix to talk to us about all of this. And Morgan, start with that campaign to get this law, SB 1070, passed. What were you hearing?
Robin, we started hearing some, well, I guess there's no other way to call it than increasingly bizarre statements from some of our elected officials. Governor Jan Brewer made a statement to the national media saying something about headless bodies in the desert, that local law enforcement had found headless bodies in the desert. In fact, we talked to coroners from all of the border counties, and they found that none of these so-called headless bodies had ever been found in the desert here in Arizona. So we started our investigation with these statements, and for about 2 months, every time you turned on the national news, it seemed you saw an elected official from Arizona talking about how dangerous Arizona is.
In fact, you put together a montage, ads from Senate campaigns like that of John McCain and other officials speaking. Let's listen.
Terrorists can come across, the kidnappings and the extortion and the beheadings.
Home invasions, murder.
Out of control and violence has increased.
Does this look safe to you?
So, Morgan Lowe, what did you find was true about crime rates in Arizona?
Well, we found the exact opposite was true. First of all, the crime rate across the state has been dropping every year for over 6 years. For example, in the city of Phoenix, we have half the number of murders this year than we had in 2003.
What about illegal immigrants crossing the border?
That's another area where the numbers just do not reflect what we've been hearing. Half the number of illegal immigrants appear to be crossing the border today than they were in 2003. Those numbers have been dropping consistently as well.
There have been some high-profile violent crime acts, though. There was the killing of a rancher. So it's not as if all is quiet there on the front. But what you have people saying in your report is that unless you are an illegal immigrant or in a drug gang, it's actually safer in Arizona than it ever has been.
Arizona is safer than it's been for years. Those niche crime areas, the drug smuggling, the people smuggling, those are more dangerous than they've ever been. There is always potential that an innocent person is going to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. That's an example of that Robert Krentz, the rancher that you mentioned, killed, by all accounts, it appears, from a drug smuggler or a drug smuggling scout in southeastern Arizona.
Yeah. But you have these two conflicting images, one, the stats saying that the crime has actually gone down, the other, state lawmakers painting this picture. What's been the impact on tourism?
We're down about 10% in tourism over the last year. I can tell you that between the boycotts of SB 1070, our tough new immigration law, and these statements in the Phoenix area, reservations and what they call a direct impact on the economy is down about $90 million.
Well, and you spoke to a couple innkeepers. What was their business and what did they say?
They have just a tremendous historical guest ranch that's what you imagine, sort of an old-fashioned dude ranch. When they see our political figures on the air talking about how dangerous Arizona is, they just cringe. They'd had several cancellations because people said, we just don't want to go down there because it just sounds like it's too dangerous.
Let's hear just a comment from Richard Schultz of the Rancho de la Osa guest ranch.
I think they're covering their own personal interests, and as a consequence, Arizona, the state of Arizona, and its tourism needs are being the sacrificial lambs to some extent.
So, Morgan Lowe, that's what at least one innkeeper thinks is the impact on tourism. But you also looked deeper and wondered, well, who benefits from this tough language and this tough new illegal immigration law? And you wondered, was it the private prison industry because of connections between two top aides and Governor Brewer? Who are they?
What we found out is these two aides in the Brewer administration were lobbyists and are lobbyists for the Corrections Corporation of America. One of them is the director of communications for the governor. He was a lobbyist for CCA. His wife currently is a lobbyist for CCA. And then the governor's policy advisor, as well as campaign chairman is a current lobbyist for CCA. We also found out that CCA officials had individually made contributions to the governor's reelection campaign.
Well, Paul Sensiman is the governor's deputy chief of staff, the former lobbyist for CCA, whose wife is a current lobbyist for the company. Chuck Coughlin is one of the governor's advisors and her campaign chair, and his company currently, as you say, lobbies for CCA. You asked Governor Brewer about these connections. Let's listen.
Did Paul Sensiman or Chuck Coughlin have any input with you on signing SB 1070 into law?
Okay, we're done.
Are you aware that they were lobbyists for Corrections Corporation of America?
Sorry, Morgan.
Governor, don't you think you should have disclosed that?
The governor at this point walks away from you, Morgan Lowe. And what does the Corrections Corporation of America, again, which runs some of these prisons and some would say would stand to benefit if more illegal immigrants are rounded up and more prisons are needed, what has CCA said?
They have said that they did not lobby the governor or the legislature in favor of this law and that they currently have no contracts with the state of Arizona or local entities to house illegal immigrants. That may be true, but there is a way to connect an illegal immigrant being picked up under SB 1070 and CCA. Because here's what would happen. If an illegal immigrant commits a crime or is picked up by, say, Phoenix Police Department, they would be taken down to the local county jail. At that point, their immigration status would be checked with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. If that person is, in fact, in this country illegally, ICE takes possession of that person, and then they head to the CCA facility because CCA has the contract with Immigration and Customs Enforcement to house all the illegal immigrants that ICE takes possession of here in Arizona. Right now, that contract's worth between $10 and $11 million a month.
Well, and then you had a new question that came up just a couple of weeks ago. Do these private prisons work? We had that high-profile prison break 2 weeks ago. Three men, two of them convicted of first and second-degree murder, a third of attempted murder, literally walked out of one of those prisons. Two have since been caught.
After this incident, I think a lot of people here in Arizona started to question who was in these private prisons because they were originally designed to hold, for the most part, DUI offenders, nonviolent offenders. Well, now we come to find out that in that particular facility in Kingman, there were over 100 convicted murderers. So it appears that over the last few years, the state of Arizona has begun shifting more violent, more dangerous people into these private prisons as the state is shifting more toward privatizing the prison system.
Morgan Lowe with CBS 5 News in Phoenix, Arizona. He's been speaking to us from Public Radio's KJZZ in Phoenix as well. Morgan, thank you.
Robin, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
And a quick note, you can watch Morgan's story about private prisons in Arizona at our website, hereandnow.org. But meanwhile, what's the prison snapshot across the country? Coming up next, life for stealing a bicycle, 8 years for importing lobsters in a plastic bag instead of a box. We'll look at the charge that there is over-incarceration across America. Also, later today, a new movement among Native Americans, tribes whose lands were once taken for them, are setting an example on restoring the environment. That's later today. Back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We've all heard the statistics about the growing prison population. One American adult in 100 is behind bars. For young black men, it's 1 in 9. The incarceration rate in the U.S. has quadrupled since 1970. Well, our next guest took a look at those statistics and concluded that high incarceration levels are created by what he calls a ratchet effect. Politicians feeling they have to ratchet up the laws passed by their predecessors. Robert Guest is business editor for The Economist. His article is titled Crime and Punishment in America, Rough Justice. And he joins us from The Economist studios in London. Welcome, Robert.
Delighted to be here.
So tell us more about this ratchet effect. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you're a politician and you want to make a name for yourself, a good way of doing that is to say that you're going to be tough on crime. Everybody hates criminals. Nobody likes being mugged. Nobody wants to be murdered. But the thing is, because every politician has the same incentives here, if you want to come up with something that's tougher than what there is at the moment. You have to come up with a system that's tougher than the last guy who wanted to sound tough proposed. So it just gets tougher and tougher and tougher every year. And you end up with in America, perhaps because it's more democratic, more responsive to the people than most other Western countries, you find that the incarceration rate in America has just got way out of line with the rest of the world. You've got roughly 1 in 100 adults behind bars. That's about 5 times the rate in the UK, which is considered pretty punitive by European standards. It's 9 times more than Germany, and it's 12 times more than Japan.
Well, let's take a look at some of the laws that you cite. The 3-strike laws, people are pretty familiar with those. 3 strikes, you're out, and no judge can overrule that. It was originally designed to put away persistently violent criminals, but give us some examples of how 3 strikes is now affecting people.
Well, in a number of states, they've extended 3 strikes laws so that it's not just violent criminals, but just persistent criminals of any sort. So you have in California, for example, there are several thousand people who've committed neither a violent nor a serious offense, but are still in prison for life. In Alabama, there was a guy called Gerald Sanders who was locked up for life for stealing a bicycle. These are punishments that are just way out of proportion with what would be just.
Well, and then you also write about obscure laws and arcane laws still on the books and or interpretations of laws leading to things like a lobsterman in jail for 8 years. Tell us the story of the lobsterman.
There are about 4,000 federal laws that carry criminal penalties and a much larger number of regulations. They can be in quite obscure areas, like things to do with the environment, things to do with workplace safety. A lot of people don't know about these things, and a lot of people can't be expected to know about these things. So you have the example of the lobster man. I mean, there were these 4 Americans who were charged with importing lobster tails in plastic bags rather than cardboard boxes, and having a cargo where I think 3% of the lobsters had tails that were slightly too short. Now, they were judged to have fallen afoul of the Lacey Act. This is something which bars Americans from breaking foreign rules when hunting or fishing. The original intent was to prevent Americans from, doing big, bad things like poaching elephants in Kenya. But some prosecutors interpret it to mean that Americans have to abide by every single footling wildlife regulation on the planet. So these lobster guys, they had no idea they were breaking the law, but 3 of them got 8 years.
Because it was Honduran law that they broke. It's the Honduran law about plastic bags versus boxes. And
not only, it's worse than that. It's a Honduran regulation that Honduras no longer enforces.
Well, you write about moves away from this kind of sentencing. Some people are moving to community sentencing. The Atlantic magazine has a piece this month about a move towards electronic surveillance of the convicted, ankle braces instead of a prison cell to get people out of prisons. But you say also what? Change the laws, fewer laws, clearer laws?
Well, I think it's a fundamental principle of the common law tradition that you don't get locked up unless you've broken a law which you either know to be wrong, you either know that something's against the law, or you can be expected to know that it's against the law. So everybody knows that killing and stealing are wrong. But not everybody understands the arcane permutations of laws to do with corporate governance. So when you're starting to hand out very long sentences for things that people can't reasonably be expected to know were wrong, then the system is out of whack.
Well, and according to the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a nonprofit, reducing the incarceration rate by half, which would bring it back to 1993 levels, would save the U.S. about $17 billion a year. But as you well know, if one person is let out of jail in the U.S. because someone decides there was an arcane ruling or law, and that person commits a crime, it ratchets back up again.
The story of someone who was released early and then went on to kill someone always makes the headlines. The stories of the many people who festered in jail for their entire lifetimes, long past the time when they were a threat to society. That doesn't make the headlines, but you've got 200,000 old people in American prisons. Now, these guys are almost entirely not dangerous to society. It serves almost no purpose to keep them there. The deterrent effect of, the first couple of years in prison can be very large. But turning a 20-year sentence into a 40-year sentence makes very little difference to the actions of an 18-year-old hoodlum who's thinking about robbing a gas station. So there's a strong argument for letting out people who are not dangerous, who are not a threat to society, and that's something that kicks in when you get older.
Robert Guest, business editor for The Economist. His article, Crime and Punishment in America, Rough Justice, appeared in a recent issue. We'll link you to it at herenow.org. Robert, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And this news follow-up. Conservative radio talk show host Laura Schlesinger is calling it quits.
I'm here to say that my contract is up for my radio show at the end of the year, and I've made the decision not to do radio anymore. The reason is I want to regain my First Amendment rights.
Dr. Laura, as she called, went on to say she felt encumbered by radio regulations, but she's still apologizing for comments she made earlier on a recent show when she said the N-word 11 times to a listener who'd complained that she'd been called that word and thought it was racist. Here is part of Schlesinger's response to that listener.
I hope everybody heard it. So what
they did, and I'll say it again. Is what you hear on HB. Why don't you let me finish a sentence?
In other words, Schlesinger saying the word was not offensive. General Motors and Motel 6 both pulled their support from her show after those remarks. As we said, she now said she is leaving radio. Laura Schlesinger will pursue other endeavors. Back after the latest news, here and now. The federal prosecutor in the Rob Blagojevich case says he's going back for round two. A federal jury in Chicago yesterday deadlocked on all but one of the 24 charges against the former Illinois governor. On the most serious charge, trying to sell President Obama's former Senate seat, the vote was deadlocked at 11-1. On the Today Show this morning, jury foreman James Matsumoto said as prosecutors move forward, they should streamline the case, keep things simpler.
Concentrate on areas where they have more information and not rely so much on witness testimony, which was sometimes weak, and that's where we split the most.
Robert Wildebohr covered the trial for WBEZ in Chicago, and Rob, another juror, Eric Sarnello, said that prosecutors confused jurors by not following a clear timeline. And the foreman also said today that the one female juror who held out on that serious vote said all those damning taped phone calls, which were pretty incriminating for many who heard them, to her they sounded just like politics. Your thoughts?
Well, I think that obviously prosecutors want to listen very closely to jurors as they are trying this again. But at the same time, you know, we just heard the jury foreman saying that they found it confusing. Well, the fact is that they voted 11-1 on the Senate seat charges, so they didn't find it confusing. It was just that one of them disagreed, and as to why she disagreed, you know, you mentioned politics, and that's what I've heard as well. That was one of the arguments the defense had raised, that, hey, this was just a lot of talk, and this was just, you know, political horse trading. But a juror I talked to said, well, you know, political horse trading, that's fine if Blagojevich is trying to get something for the state of Illinois. But if he's trying to get something for himself, that's not political horse trading.
So when you say, you know, it's jury selection, are you saying that prosecutors feel that if they can avoid that one woman next time around, they may have better chances?
Well, I'm not saying prosecutors are saying that. I'm saying that it seems to me that it was a jury selection issue because 11 of the jurors agreed that Blagojevich did try to sell the Senate seat. And I sat in the trial, and if you listen to those tapes, there's no way a reasonable person can come away from that and say Blagojevich wasn't trying to make money for himself in appointing someone to that Senate seat. A reasonable person could disagree, you know, as to whether that's a crime or not. But you definitely see that he was trying to get something for himself in that. And the fact that 11 jurors saw that, and the way the jurors summed it up is they said this holdout juror just didn't see things the way they did. And so that's why I think it sounds like that this was kind of decided in jury selection.
Well, one Chicago political consultant, Dan Rose, says that Blagojevich's antics outside of the trial, you know, he was on Trump's show and everything, may have successfully poisoned the jury pool, you know, going forward. Your thoughts?
I think that, again, with the 11-1 that we saw on the marquee count here, that the jurors got it, and the jurors agreed with prosecutors. So you had one holdup here, but for the most part, the jurors agreed with it, and the prosecutors get more whacks at this. So, you know, a deadlocked jury, if it was 6-6, in terms of what the jurors thought of the guilt, then maybe you're saying, okay, Blagojevich made a good case and maybe he can pull that off again. But at 11-1 on some of the serious charges, it's tough to see, you know, that he can pull that off forever.
Well, the jury also deadlocked on 4 felony counts against Blagojevich's brother Robert, his co-defendant. As we said, the one count held against Blagojevich, he now faces up to 5 years in prison, convicted of lying to federal agents. But we have you there in Chicago, Robert. In the minute we have, what are people saying?
People are astounded and people are, you know, kind of, wow, we have to go through all this again because it's been such a huge show from the get-go. But you mentioned the brother Robert, and he did come off as a sympathetic character, and a juror told me that they were more divided on that, that that was more like 5-7, 6-6. They couldn't agree on Robert. More of them showed that they didn't want to convict Robert compared to Rod. So that may bode well for him in a future trial if prosecutors decide to retry him as well.
That's Robert Wildebohr, a reporter with WBEZ in Chicago, reacting to the outcome in the Rod Blagojevich trial, which may be, you know, the first in a series. Robert, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, we're going to take a break. Coming up, Native Americans setting an example on how to be stewards of the environment. That's in 30 seconds here and now. In Minnesota, the Chippewa Indians have restored a ravaged walleye population. In New Mexico, the Santa Clara Pueblo have restored 75 acres of wetlands. And in Florida, Seminoles are trying to revive the Big Cypress Swamp and the Everglades. It's all part of a growing movement of Native American tribes restoring their natural connection to the land. As Chuck Bowden writes, those whose lands were once taken from them, those once dominated often brutally by the U.S. government, are setting an example on how to steward the environment. Chuck Bowden's story is in the August issue of National Geographic, along with incredibly beautiful photographs taken by Jack Dikinga. You can see both at our website, herenow.org. And Chuck Bowden joins us from his home in Patagonia, Arizona. Chuck, welcome as always.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
And how did this Indian work to restore land? Can you pinpoint where it started?
The first gesture or move was in 1979 by the Salish and Kootenai people up in Montana. They created tens of thousands of acres of wilderness. And this was before gambling money or anything hit these tribes. Mm-hmm. Since then, this has spread. And what I think is significant is not the magnitude of it, but who's doing it. We're dealing with Native Americans who once owned the whole country, then were restricted to fragments of it and left in economic ruin for over a century. And now they're doing it not to make money setting up these reserves. They're doing it to heal the earth and to heal themselves. And, of course, I'm sitting here, a non-Indian, and I must say it brings me up short about my own behavior and what I do.
Well, and you mentioned the gambling money. Now many tribes have very successful casinos. Is some of that money being plowed back into these efforts?
Some of it. One of the groups in the story is the Santa Clara Pueblo above Santa Fe on the Rio Grande. And they have casinos and assets. And they are taking 8 miles of a canyon and restoring the wetlands. This canyon had been ravaged by overgrazing. The beaver had been trapped out. And because of a forest fire that was set in a nearby national monument that almost consumed Los Alamos and burned part of this canyon, they decided to just fix it. And so they are. And, you know, these are, as I say, these are small efforts to the eye, and you can say, well, they're just using gambling money. But basically, they're repealing 500 years of history.
Yeah, and it would be like corporations deciding, let's just pour our money, you know, back into doing efforts to restore the land, only, as you said, with the added historical slice that this was their land at one time and taken away. And it's also interesting because, you know, many people look at what Indians have created with casinos, and they call that a blight upon the land. You know, a lot of people don't like the casinos.
Well, I'm one of those people. Mm-hmm. Having said that, this is a step in the right direction. I can't speak of this sitting here now and not have in my mind the thought that my country poisoned an entire sea, the Gulf of Mexico, this summer with a runaway oil well and justified it because we have to have oil and damn the price. These lands that these tribes are setting aside will never of economic value to them. They are not restoring the trees so they can cut them down. They're not putting in the beavers so they can trap them and sell skins. They are simply retiring it.
Well, give us some other examples. The Assiniboine, the Sioux?
Up in the Dakotas, they're restoring buffalo herds. And, you know, to me, in many ways, the most moving one is in California, about 200 miles north of San Francisco. There's a consortium of tribes. And California, at the time of settlement, had many, many separate little nations, over 400 languages. When we conquered it, and the California Gold Rush then occurred immediately afterwards, thousands of young, hungry, ambitious men poured in. And the native people were not simply pushed aside. They were slaughtered like game animals. Fragments of these groups survive. And in what's called the Lost Coast, the part that's impenetrable, they have taken 3,900 acres, beaten back timber companies, beaten back people like myself, essentially environmentalists, and they are restoring the redwoods, they're restoring the salmon, and they're restoring it forever, and they never intend to make a dime out of it. They want to go there and remember who they were and hopefully become who they were again.
Well, and you're right that some of these Native Americans tell you they want to return to a rhythm as old as the mountains, and it sounds beautiful and poignant.
Anybody that's traveled and visited, spent time on reservations, which I have most of my life, knows that there are deep problems on them of alcoholism, despair, suicide, etc. So this kind of medicine, to use a metaphor, that they're making is something I fully understand, and it benefits the natural world. And as I said earlier, it's a kind of benchmark for the rest of us to examine and think about the way we live and treat land. Mm-hmm.
Well, and you do point out that it wasn't just the white man who did harm to the land, although he did the majority. Native Americans are aware that they manipulated the land. They cut and burned forests.
Yeah, I mean, there's a sense of self-violation in a lot of Native American peoples. They're not saints. If they were saints, they wouldn't move me because I can't be a saint. They're people. And for them to recognize mistakes they've made makes me think maybe I better look at my own mistakes. And that's the purpose of the story, really, besides Jack's beautiful photographs.
drove the buffalo off cliffs, I'm thinking, in a book that we did, and then slaughtered them below. And now, as you say,
there's no question. Yeah. One of the things that held back Native Americans was a lack of firepower. But they made a dent in the natural world. This was not Eden when Columbus found it. Human beings had manipulated it, but nothing to the level we see today. And so, as I said, this is a kind of wake-up call they've had on their own, and I think where the rest of us should think about the wake-up call, too. You know, these are modern people that are doing this. They are not living in wigwams. They're riding around in cars. They're not that different from the people listening to this program, except in two things. They have a different past, and they have a different memory. And they have this memory that's come down of a relationship with the land when it wasn't a commodity, and they want to somehow get a feeling of that back.
That's Chuck Bowden. His story about this environmental movement among Native American tribes, restoring and preserving tribal lands as wilderness, appears in the August National Geographic. We'll have a link at herenow.org. By the way, his latest book is Murder City, Ciudad Juarez and the Global Economy's New Killing Fields. We'll link you to that as well. Chuck, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Americans love a winner and will not tolerate a loser. Americans play to win all the time. I wouldn't give a hoot in hell for a man who lost and laughed. That's why Americans have never lost and will never lose a war, because the very thought of losing is hateful to Americans.
George C. Scott's Oscar-winning performance in the World War II film Patton, the film that Richard Nixon watched repeatedly in the private movie theater right in the White House. When any president wants to see a movie, going to the multiplex is pretty much out of the question, so with one phone call, they can watch at home. So what did they watch? Jimmy Carter's first screening was All the President's Men, the story of Nixon's demise. But what about FDR? What about President Obama? Ted Johnson is deputy editor of Variety. He's also author of the blog WilshireandWashington.com. It's about the intersection of entertainment and politics. And he joins us from the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California. Ted, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So what is Barack Obama watching?
Well, he's pretty much watching what everyone else is watching. He's seen Star Trek. He's seen Slumdog Millionaire. He's seen The Pacific, which was HBO's big miniseries that came on last March. But we also don't know a lot of them. Hollywood and the White House long ago made this arrangement whereby the president can pretty much use the industry as his own personal Netflix. Just call up and say, I want to see this movie or that movie, and the studios will get it to him overnight. But a lot of that information is kept private, and the press folks at the White House really do this by saying that the White House screening room, which is officially known as the White House Family Theater, is actually part of the private quarters, so they're really not obliged to say anything about it. Nevertheless, there are movies that the White House has been anxious to actually get out there to show that the president has been screening. The Pacific, the president invited a whole bunch of World War II veterans. PBS had its National Parks miniseries, and he screened that with Ken Burns and Dayton Duncan, the two producers of that. He screened Nuclear Tipping Point, which is a documentary that seemed to gel really well with his nuclear proliferation conference that he had back in April. But then there are movies that they're less anxious to actually get out there that the president has seen, things like this new Star Trek that came out last year. And I think it was the Republican Trekkies that were kind of on his case as saying, why does the president get entitled to see that on his own in his own private screening room, and we don't?
Well, and tell us a little more about the history. FDR had the screening room built in 1942. Was it just for convenience, or was there some more thinking to it?
Well, FDR and Winston Churchill loved to watch movies together. I'm sure they both watched a lot of the Warner Brothers movies because FDR was friends with Jack Warner, and a lot of movies that were about the war and in the propaganda campaign that Hollywood was engaged in about the war. FDR in particular liked watching some of the musicals of the day. You know, he said that his favorite movie was Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
Just whistle while you work. And cheerfully together we can tidy up the place. So I'm a merry too.
But not a lot was really known about exactly what the president's movie selections were at the time, for a lot of reasons that records just weren't even kept. It wasn't until the 1950s that we really know what the president's movie selections are, and that is thanks in large part to a guy named Paul Fisher. He was the White House projectionist, and he was hired by Eisenhower in large part because he was the only one around who really knew how to operate the projector, and he ended up staying through the Reagan administration. And unknown to most people is that Fisher actually kept records, meticulous records, of what the president watched, who was in the room with the president, and sometimes even what the reaction of the president was as they were screening the movie.
How about John F. Kennedy or Lyndon Johnson? Just give us a thumbnail of their movie viewing.
Well, the last movie that John F. Kennedy saw was actually From Russia with Love, which is not much of a surprise because he was a big James Bond fan. He also saw the movie The Manchurian Candidate in 1962, which was really somewhat chilling because that movie was actually pulled from circulation after the assassination. And during the Cuban Missile Crisis, he really went for escapism. He watched Roman Holiday. I think one of the most intriguing things is, what do the presidents watch during the midst of a crisis? There was an incident in 1966 where a plane actually crashed and it was carrying hydrogen bombs. Obviously, the bombs did not explode, but one sunk to the bottom of the Mediterranean. And during that time, Lyndon Johnson went and watched another James Bond movie, which was Thunderball. And that movie has somewhat of the same plot. It shows the evil Spectra organization actually trying to retrieve a bomb from the bottom of the ocean, and James Bond trying to stop it.
My dear Prime Minister, two atomic bombs, which were aboard NATO Flight 759, are now in the possession of Spectra. Unless within the next 7 days your government pays to us £100 million sterling, shall destroy a major city in England or the United States of America.
My favorite is about Lyndon Johnson. He wasn't overall that much of a movie watcher, but one thing that he really liked to watch was this 10-minute documentary about himself. It was made in the wake of the Kennedy assassination, and it was narrated by Gregory Peck, and it is definitely propaganda, and it shows the president very august in the Oval Office, and the message is definitely that you can be confident in his leadership.
What else do we learn from this? I mean, for instance, Bill Clinton has said High Noon, the 1952 Western with Gary Cooper, was his favorite movie of all time. If we knew that he sat there and watched that over and over again in his screening room, can we then jump to, you know, he pictured himself as this, you know, Gary Cooper character? We really don't know anything by knowing what a president watched.
I think sometimes you can actually read into it. Again, thanks to Paul Fisher's records, but also thanks to the fact that President Clinton, probably more than any other recent president, didn't seem to care, you know, what movies got out there. He had a very close relationship with Hollywood. He invited a lot of his friends. There was one instance when Bill Clinton allowed the director David Russell to screen Three Kings. It was made post-First Iraq War, and it really did show how the U.S. kind of abandoned the Shiite movement in Iraq, kind of leaving them to fend for themselves. And Clinton really thought that this movie was a great argument for why we may actually have to go back into Iraq. And the reason we know this is Clinton allowed Russell to take his video camera in there and show him actually talking about the movie and his reaction to the movie. Just in the past few administrations, we're seeing the use of the screening room to really show these socially relevant movies, these politically charged movies that can often serve part of the president's agenda or even part of the president's image making.
Ted Johnson, deputy editor for Variety, author of the blog WilshireandWashington.com about the intersection of entertainment and politics. Ted, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Black
And here are some more of Ted's findings. Just as JFK was a big James Bond fan, George W. Bush liked watching the Austin Powers films. In 1915, Woodrow Wilson screened the first movie at the White House. This was before the private theater was built. And it was D.W. Griffith's controversial Birth of a Nation, which celebrated the KKK. And the only X-rated film known to be screened at the White House was Midnight Cowboy, and that was Jimmy Carter's request. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.